Welcome to New Realities. I'm Alan Steinfeld, and this program is about the evolution of our mind, body, and spirit. And there's nobody, really nobody, in my opinion, who pulls those three topics together, mind, body, and spirit, in a way that prepares us and shows us the way of evolution. That's why I'm talking today to an old friend, Bruce Lipton.
Well, first of all, dear Alan, my brother in evolution, you know, we were together, more than 10 years ago?
Well, I found you in 1989 when you did a little interview in the Golden Thread newspaper, and I said, who is this guy? And then I sought you out, I showed up at your doorstep, and, you know, in California, and we talked for a while. Anyway, yes, we go back about 15 years at least, so yes.
And it's really wonderful, because even if you go back and look at what we talked about then, it's unfolding exactly in the same plan that we talked about over 15 years ago.
Yes.
And so there's a real insight to a pattern that's unfolding right now, and it's very, very exciting. Let's just come to a very simple, basic scientific fact that says, okay, this is the game changer, and this is what the fact is. Science has established beyond doubt that we are deep into the sixth mass extinction of life on this planet. Five times in the history of this planet, life was thriving. The biosphere was just, you know, cranking, and it was really great. And then something happened five different times that just stopped. Everything stopped and disappeared. And these are called mass extinctions. And science, in trying to identify, well, what would be responsible for these mass extinctions, have picked on a couple of things very specifically, such as comets or asteroids hitting the Earth, upending the environment and wiping out life. And so if five times in our history, this has already occurred. What science has recognized today, and this is, again, this is not a question or a suggestion, this is now an established thing, that we are losing a species of organisms faster now than in the previous five mass extinctions, where our loss of species is 1,000 times greater per day now than at any time in our history. What this really emphasizes to the bio community is that we're disrupting the chain of life, that we're punching holes in this web, which will cause it to inevitably collapse. And so the fact is, yes, we are going toward a collapse. But what's the most important understanding about this is, well, the previous mass extinctions attributed to things like comets or massive geological upheaval, today's mass extinction is directly due to human behavior. And I say, well, what's significant about that? He says, well, listen, we continue the behavior track that we're on at this very minute. Just continue it. And there's no way out. Inevitable. Even NASA, with massive research, has said that industrial civilization is facing an irreversible collapse within the next few decades, which means 10, 20 years, really. And I say, well, wow, there's a choice. You can sit there in your living room and go, hey, what the hell? It's going to an end. Let's just enjoy the end of it. Or we can start to consider another way of living on this planet.
Yes, let's talk about that, because I think, you know, your work, a lot of other people are saying we need to change how we live. I mean, it's obvious. Even in the cities may even be a little greener, a little healthier, but there's too many of us uncontrolled to go on this way. So, yeah, what do you suggest?
So the reality is we're being forced to make a decision, which by definition is the foundation of evolution. It says, look, you've been living this way. Now you have to make a decision, because if you continue living this way, you're going extinct. So now it's like a new way of making a civilization. And so we are on the edge of seeing an old civilization come to an end. But it doesn't mean that when it comes to an end, everything's all over with. I mean, go back over our history. There have been civilizations come and gone. I mean, we always, when I was young, the end of the Roman civilization. It's like, well, yeah, there was a civilization, and it ended and gave way to something different. Well, the civilization we're in now is coming to that same kind of end.
Yeah.
And the only way out is to do something different, another way of life. And what we're really finding out is that our cultural beliefs that shape the way we live on the world are predicated on some very fundamental issues of science. I mean, science says this is the way life works, and then government people and political philosophers and all that say, oh, if that's the way life works, then let's create a culture that way.
Oh, wait, wait. I think that's a really key point. So our civilization is based on our belief systems, and because science is the dictator of our beliefs, it's saying because we say the world is this way, then everyone starts to live that way and doesn't think twice about it because that's how the world is, according to what our authorities tell us. But it's not that way.
No, you know, and it's interesting because, look, you know, there's a really simple understanding about this. Is why does one civilization rise and another, and then it falls, and then another one rises again? The answer is this, is that a civilization looks for what we would call a truth provider. Who knows what's going on? Who's the truth provider of what's going on? And it turns out that when we accept the beliefs of a certain group or organization, say, yes, they seem to know what life is all about, and so we will follow their principles, then we select them as a truth provider. So in the previous civilization to the one right now, the truth provider was the church, because they provided the insights of what are called the answers to what are called the perennial questions. The perennial questions have been asked for 10,000 years by humans, and whoever provides the answers to those questions that the public generally accepts, by definition, then the public also accepts that entity or organization as the provider of all truth. All truth.
Wait, let me just say the perennial questions are basically, who are we, why are we here, and what are we supposed to be doing?
Yeah, and how did we get here, all that kind of stuff like that. So the answers provided by the church in the previous civilization is, you know, we got here through divine intervention, that we're here to live out plays of morality. That's why we're here, to see if we're worthy to go to that other place they suggested. And then they say, well, how do you live here? And they say, well, we have the rules of the Bible, and you live by spiritual rules. And it's interesting because when we accepted those answers, we accepted the church as the truth provider. And if you had any questions about life, and you want a truth, you go to the guy wearing the black coat, the priest.
Right.
And then I say, and about 1869, the answers to the questions changed because rather than divine intervention as our source, science, that Darwinian point of view, recognized, oh my God, it's heredity that is provided for this, genetics, essentially. And so instead of invoking God as our source, now in today's world, science has taken over the truth providing because people believe that science's answers are more accurate to them than church's answers.
Right. They can talk, another belief system, basically, because they really, maybe they know a little bit more than the church. We have to give them some credit, but not much.
But the fact is, since they're antagonistic, then, you know, then all of a sudden some of the church's things were left out because they're antagonistic to each other. But here's the funny part about it. Then you say, oh, once we accepted science's answers to those perennial questions, then we saw science as the source of truth. And no longer do we go to the guy wearing the black coat for our truth. We now go to the guy wearing the white coat
for our truth. That is funny.
It is to me. It's kind of funny because we change uniforms now. So we say, well, what's true? And I say, well, what science says is true. And then I say, oh, if science says it's true and evolution is right and evolution is based on competition and a struggle for survival, then life is competition and struggle for survival.
And not only that, it's based on freak mutations that
exactly.
The first step
in a Darwinian theory is what's called a random mutation. Mm-hmm. And you say, oh, well, then the mutations that take us from a primitive form to a more advanced form were accidents. Well, right. If that's random, yes, of course it's an accident. But then I say, philosophically, what does that mean at the ground level, that random mutations? I go, oh, ask a question. What is the purpose of human life on this planet? And then you go back and you go, well, hey, it happened by accident, so there's no purpose for us to be here. So enjoy it, do what you want.
Destroy the planet because it doesn't mean anything.
Doesn't mean anything.
Who cares, right?
And now we understand, wait, there's a complete misunderstanding that evolution is not Darwinian. It's not based on competition. It's not driven by random mutations. That it's actually driven by something like adaptive mutations or beneficial mutations versus random. And I said, what's the difference? I said, beneficial mutation is an organism adjusting its genetics to be compatible with the environment. Right. If you're compatible with the environment, then you get supported.
Right.
But an organism that is outside of compatibility, that challenges the systems, challenges the life community, that nature view is like, well, you guys are like a virus on the system. You're destroying my garden. And nature has inevitably over history removed any life form that has come into the garden and destroyed the harmony. Well, then you look at it and go, yes. And you can see why we're on the edge of this great, colossal change, because either we learn to live in harmony with that environment, or the environment's going to get rid of us.
So you're saying basically our philosophy is what's doing us in and the rest of the planet because of the narrow belief system dictated by our science, and what you're so important and instrumental in leading the way of you could call it Lamarckian revolution, where
it is.
Where the organism evolves in concert with the environment. It's not random. It's dictated by where we're living. You know, it makes so much. How could they not know this?
Well, at the time, you know, the genetic story was they already came in with an answer. You see, this is where science could go wrong. And I say, what is it? Theoretically, science is supposed to ask a question and say, okay, whatever the answer is, I'll accept it and I'll move in that direction. And I say, yeah, and how are we doing science today? And the answer is, oh, we have a suggestion of how it works, and then we ask science, does it work the way we said it works? Which means you've already focused on a mechanism before you even did the science. And therefore, you already have a belief before you did the science what the outcome is going to be. And therefore, when you do the science, it's no longer science. You already have a destination. What you're looking for is how to get to the destination.
But isn't that the problem within the scientific inquiry in general? You have to have a hypothesis to ask the question, and then you go about proving it in any way you can.
Well, you see, the question, as you just said, proving it any way you can. So if your hypothesis is not exactly right, but your mission is what? To prove it any way I can.
Exactly.
Then you will adjust your research or you select your data to fit what you want. And if the data doesn't fit what you want, well, you ignore it. And then what do you report on? Oh, all the data suggests everything we just said. And I said, no, you just selected that data to fit what you wanted to say.
Right.
But that's not real science, because you can you do a hypothesis not to say, I want to prove the hypothesis. You actually have to say to nature, is my hypothesis right? I am open to you, nature, to give me the answer. Well, today's world is a little different. I'm telling nature, this is what I want. Show me the answer. And here's a simple fact. The British Journal of Medicine did research on results of experiments based on who gave the money. And when they looked at the same kind of research on the same topic, but then split it into research part that was funded by pharmaceutical industry and research part that was funded by public money, they found when the same research was funded by pharmaceutical money, the results came out 4 times more in their favor.
Wow.
And it's like, well, what does that mean? It's like, well, you already have a bias. You came in with a bias. So when you look at the data, if it doesn't fit your bias, you throw that data out and you keep doing experiments until data that fits your bias comes in. You go, see what I told you? See, it was true. And it's like, no.
You're absolutely right. So let's get back to how we're going to change everything now that we realize that the old way doesn't work.
Well, we have to recognize what the current science does not support some important things. There are 4 belief systems. One, we just talked about evolution. The current science does not support the belief of evolution, which gave us a vision that to survive in this world, it's a dog-eat-dog world. Go out there and fight. It's a rat race. If you stop, somebody's going to run over you. And so we bought into that belief system. I go, no. Number one, it's just totally wrong, because now we know what? Evolution is based on cooperation. A garden.
Well, wait, I know you're just saying that. I don't want to make you another black or white coat. Give me evidence or tell me why you think that is true.
Because when we look at the evolution, we start to find that, I'll give you an example. Why do we have animals? Because we started with only plants. I go, so why have animals? The answer is very simple. What happened is this. Plants breathe in carbon dioxide and release oxygen in the process of photosynthesis, you know, growing of the plant. So I say, okay, you start off at a static balance place, so much oxygen, so much carbon dioxide. You put plants in the environment. I say, what happens? Well, after a short time, the plants use the carbon dioxide and add more oxygen. So over time, oxygen levels go up and carbon dioxide levels go down. They say, well, that's okay. And I say, no, why not? Because if the oxygen levels get too high, guess what happens? A lightning strike, boom, the whole thing catches fire. So in fact, in our history, when there were only plants, it created an imbalance in the system. Too much oxygen in the environment, too much oxygen became toxic, it burned up, and life got lost. So you say, well, how can you have plants if you keep getting too much oxygen? So you say, let's introduce animals. You say, what do you mean? I introduce a new species. I say, what do they do? Oh, they breathe in oxygen and release carbon dioxide. That's a complete complement to plants.
But who's making these decisions? I mean, where's the evolutionary engine for that type of creation? I mean, we don't have to call it God, but where's it come from?
It comes from stress.
Okay.
When an organism is in stress, it has to adjust its biology to survive. That's as simple as that. You don't adjust your biology, stress kills. That's bottom line. So I said, well, then an organism can change its genetics. And I go, yes. And yet in our history and our story of our conventional world of science is, no, you can't control genetics. Genetics are there. And if there's a mistake, we call it a mutation. But you have no control over it. Therefore, we have had the belief that, oh, well, life is driven by these accidents and mutations. I have no control. I could get cancer. That's an accident. Then I die. And, you know, that's the way life is. Now we find out, wait, that belief in genetics is not correct. There's another science called epigenetics.
Yeah.
And you say, well, that sounds the same. And I go, no, it's a revolution. And that's why what's happening right now is revolutionary. And I say, what do you mean revolution? I go, under the form of genetics, the belief was what we call genetic control, control by genes. I said, well, why is that relevant? Because people believe if they get a gene like the BRCA1 cancer gene, that they're going to, I'm going to get cancer. If I get this Alzheimer gene, I'm going to get that. I'm going to get cardiovascular disease. Why? I'm inheriting the genes, and the genes control my life. Why? Because genes operate independently of us. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, what's the meaning of that? And I said, we're victims of our heredity. I'm culturing you to believe that you have no control over your life. The genes did it. You got cancer genes? Well, then get ready because cancer is coming.
Like the Angelina Jolie situation, you know.
Right.
Awful.
It's exactly. That's the expression of a belief system that says that your life is not under your control. It's under control of genes. And since I have the BRCA1 gene, says Angelique, I'm going to be liable for breast cancer. So if I remove my breast, then I can't get the cancer. And she did that. And then only later then finds out, well, it's not just your breast, because your ovaries and your uterus could have effect by the same gene. So then she went through and had her ovaries and uterus taken out. Why? Well, those parts are gone. Now I'm not going to get the cancer.
And that's based on fallacies and thinking. Turn it all around.
Well, let's turn it around right now. Here's the turnaround right now, Alan, is simply this. Oh, the BRCA1 gene is called the cancer gene, the breast cancer gene. I go, yes, absolutely. And I say, then everybody got the gene should get cancer. And I go, oh, well, that's the problem. Only 50% of the women that have the gene get the cancer. And I say, well, wait a minute. I thought you said the gene is called the cancer gene. It gives me cancer. I go, yeah, but 50%, half the people that have the gene don't get the cancer. And I say, what does that mean? Basic, what does it mean? I go, oh, it means this. Having the gene doesn't cause cancer. That's basically what it says. I said, but you told me it was a cancer gene. I go, having the gene does not cause cancer. Why? 50% of the people that have the gene don't get the cancer. I go, then what was different about them? And I say, you know, we never study that. We only study the ones with the cancer. I say, yeah, but 50% don't get the cancer and they have the gene. Then what does it mean? The gene does not cause cancer. Something else does.
Yeah. What was different about those women? Yes.
And now we're beginning to find out it's stress. 90% of the illness on this planet is really tied into stress. Less than 1% of the illness on this planet is actually controlled by genes. Less than 1%.
Everything else you're saying is attitude, beliefs, reactions.
Lifestyle, every way you're living, it's out of harmony and out of balance with the garden. Then you're moving toward
disease. Stress triggers the gene, you're saying.
Absolutely, 100%. The gene did not trigger the stress. It was the stress that triggered the gene. Relevant, you get rid of the stress and you don't end up with the effect. And it's interesting because the same thing applies to AIDS. Mm-hmm. I said, what do you mean? I thought, well, AIDS, you got the AIDS, you're going to die. Everybody, oh, you got AIDS virus, you're going to die. And I go, you know, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of men out there that have been tested to have the AIDS virus for over 20 or 30 years. They have no disease. Again, it's like, how can that happen? The answer is because the virus itself did not cause the disease. The virus plus stress causes the disease.
So stress is our number one killer.
Absolutely, 100%. And stress means you're not living in harmony or balance in the world in which you're living, and therefore you're running up against the world, and that causes the friction, that's the stress, and that's where the illness comes from.
Which is a microcosm of the species destruction we're seeing now. We're causing stress to the earth itself.
And the stress is causing the web of life to start to collapse. We're destroying ecosystems. We're fishing out the ocean. You know, 90% of the fish that were in the ocean in 1950, gone. 90%. We're down to 10% of the fish that were in the ocean.
Wow. And we have a bigger population, actually.
It's going away. So the realistic perception of science is that within 25 or 30 years at the most, the fish will not be in the ocean. It's like, are you kidding me? It's a science fiction movie, Planet Earth with all the oceans and no fish in it. No, we are destroying the atmosphere, biosphere of the ocean. We're acidifying it. We're changing life forms. We're fishing out all the important life forms. We're destroying the breeding grounds of the life forms. And all of a sudden you say, where's all the fish? It's like, gone.
So go back to those 4 points. The first one you said was the competition cooperation.
Yes, Darwinian theory which we built our culture, because Darwinian theory is scientific and it says you want to survive, then you have to understand you're going to struggle and you're going to fight. Mm-hmm. And it turns out wrong, because survival is based on cooperation. A garden is not a battleground. A garden is a place of beauty and serenity. Yes. So when you look at the Garden of Eden, mm-hmm. Was it designed as a battleground? No, but according to Darwinian theory, it is. So who's right? Darwinian theory is wrong. Organisms adjust to the environment. As we make the environment bad, then the health of the humans get bad. Mm-hmm. Our health is the direct connection to the environment. And when a person is sick, mm-hmm. it's not because they're generally organically anything wrong with them, except they're in complement to their perception or the way they respond to the environment. They see the environment as unhealthy, then they become unhealthy. Number two is the mechanisms of how the universe work. Well, that's physics. Physics is the science of mechanism. That's why I say Newtonian mechanics, Newtonian physics, they're the same thing. Oh, then as physics equals mechanics. I go, absolutely. The mechanisms of how the universe work are physics. And I say, well, what's relevant? Because we live in a world based on an old belief system called Newtonian physics that says that there's a physical realm, it's separate from the energy realm, that the energy realm, physical realms don't interact with each other. And since your body is a physical thing, if you want to understand it, then you only look at the physical attributes of life.
Biomechanics.
Okay, and I go, well, that's interesting, except in 1925, physics changes point of view because it recognized that atoms are actually not physical material. Atoms are vortices of energy. And if atoms are energy, then they're connected to the energy of everything. And therefore, the whole belief that energy and matter were separate is completely gone. And it says that energy and matter are one and the same. I say, why is it relevant? Because now, physics says energy is more significant in shaping matter. So that matter isn't shaping itself. Energy is shaping. And I go, what's energy? Thoughts are energy. The field of information is energy. I go, oh, you mean how you think changes your biology? I go, 100%. Wow. 100%. And all of a sudden it says, then your thoughts are influencing your health. I go, 100%. And why is it relevant? Because you've been led to believe that you have nothing to do with your health. The genes control that, and you don't. And it turns out, okay. And I say, well, what's controlling it? Not physical. It's the mind that is generating an energy field, and the cells become complementary to the mind. So health and disease, while seen in the physical body is one level, health and disease is an energy at another level. Yeah. And whether we're living in harmony or disharmony, it determines whether we're in health or we're in disease. So all of a sudden it says, oh my goodness, the invisible world becomes profoundly important. So here's the joke, because science has separated itself from spirituality. And I say, okay, the new science is called quantum physics, and they talk about the energy field shaping us. I say, oh, the word energy field. What's the word field? And I say, oh, in physics, the word field means invisible moving forces that influence the physical world. I go, ah, that's the same definition of spirit. Invisible moving forces that influence the physical world. I go, spirit was not scientific. Spirit was, there was observations that in some way were influencing us. since 1925, the concept of spirit now becomes part of quantum physics. It's a nature of the mechanics of the universe. Rather than throwing spirituality out, not only do we bring it back in quantum physics, but we put it at a hierarchy because it says the energy field is what shapes the material field. Since the energy field, invisible moving force, is the same as this concept of spirit, then I can just say, well, the ancient people were essentially right. There was a spiritual element to us that controls our biology. If you ignore that spiritual element, then you're missing the absolute control. So it says, okay, the biology is wrong because you're not a victim of your genes. The physics is wrong because you've left out the energy, and the energy is spirituality, and that's been talked about for thousands of years before there was science, so we've got to bring that back. And so we have the genes wrong, the physics wrong, and then I say, what about the evolution part? And I say, well, one belief in evolution is that it's a struggle for survival. So when we wake up in the morning, we're prepared to go out there and compete. And it turns out, wrong. Evolution is not based on competition. It's based on cooperation. So your relationship to other people is going to have to change. If you think that you're creating your survival through competition, you don't realize that that competition is undermining you at this moment and precipitating this extinction phase that's coming. So it says, you better wake up and realize you want to survive, then begin to understand cooperation, because that's where it comes from, not competition. And then lastly, as I said, if the random mutations are responsible for us being here, because that's the first step in evolution, it's an accidental mutation, I ask you, Alan, a very simple question, and what's the purpose of human existence? And then you would go, oh, we got here by accident.
Exactly.
So there's no purpose for us to be here.
Exactly.
So do what the hell you want. And it's like, no. Every organism that nature brought in to the environment, it did so by an intention. Why? Because the previous organisms began to throw it out of balance. So you bring a new organism in to bring in balance. Why? Life is based on balance, homeostasis. If we have radical changes in temperature, radical changes in oxygen and carbon dioxide, these radical changes would devastate life. No, we live in a very nice zone. The temperatures run within a certain block. The atmosphere has a certain composition. And you say, oh, that's just an accident of physics. I go, no. The atmosphere, the environment, the temperatures are connected to the biosphere. If we change the biosphere, then we change the relationship of life. Why were we here? Because the Native Americans already knew the answer. We were here to tend the garden, not destroy the garden. We're destroying the garden. It's like, no, you want to survive? You are a piece of the garden. You evolved from the garden, not by accident, but by intention to bring harmony and balance. The higher an organism is on the evolutionary level, the more powerful they are in influencing the environment. I say, and where do we stand? And I go, well, it's pretty damn obvious where we stand. We're at the pyramid peak of controlling all this. Why? If we lean a little bit to the left, we change the environment this way. If we lean a little bit to the right, we change the environment that way. All of a sudden, you start to realize, oh my goodness, we as a species are so powerful that we can move the environment. I go, yeah, and guess what? Without that knowledge that we were supposed to be creating balance, what have we done? We've created such an imbalance, an imbalance, that our survival is now in total question. We didn't realize we were here to promote harmony, and what have we done? We promoted competition, struggle, and the issues that face us today.
Right, the issues of extinction, not just for ourselves, but for so many of the life forms that
absolutely
that survive on and rely on balance in the earth. So, right, so what do we do? Okay, we have these four changes in our belief system. So what are these practical solutions that we can now take?
Okay, so let's look at the physics one. The physics one said it's not a Newtonian mechanical universe, it's an energy-based universe. So why is it relevant? It said, well, don't focus on the physical realm, start to focus on the invisible realm, which is including thought. And I say, why? Because thought changes your biology. And you had no belief in that because you said genes change my biology. I go, no, the invisible energy field of thought is what's controlling not just your personal biology, but the interaction with all the other organisms. Right. Vibration, energy, it's woven together. There's no, I can separate two physical things. I got a right hand and a left hand. You can see I got two hands. I say, I separate them. I'm just going to study the right hand. Then I say, in this room right now, there are television broadcasts moving through here, cell phone broadcasts, radio broadcasts. I say, separate them. Separate channel 2 from channel 4. I can't do that. All the energies. Energy is interconnected, interwoven. You cannot separate yourself from that. Physical things can be separated.
Until you have a receiver that picks up those waves.
We pick up the energy and with the vibrations, and we're supposed to learn to live in harmony with the vibrations. When you live in harmony, vibrations in harmony are music. Vibrations out of harmony is noise. And the idea is, are we living in harmony or are we making noise? And the idea is, well, we're making noise, so that obviously means we're destroying the harmony, and that's what we're seeing. So number one, bring back spirituality, bring back invisible forces, recognize the power of thought and belief, because these are the elements that actually control your biology.
And feeling, the power of feeling. So if you help yourself become peaceful and let go of stress, that's going to change your biology, as you're saying.
Well, absolutely, because you have to recognize that feelings are feedback. You drive a car, you have a dashboard, you have all the gauges. And I say, when you're driving a car, you're going to see how the performance is going. Is the engine, is it getting too hot? Is my oil pressure low? Is my gas level low? Why? Because I can adjust my car when I read the gauges.
And but we're also generators of feeling, which makes us even more powerful than just being reactors to feeling.
Yeah, because we're broadcasting our vibrational frequencies out in the world. Are you broadcasting harmony or are you broadcasting disharmony? Why? Because if the fields are going to contribute to the physical expression, if you keep broadcasting disharmony, then by definition, the physical structure will start to manifest disharmony, which is what we're doing right now. And if you want to bring it back, you better start coming back together and creating harmony within yourself and within all the community of life, including the people and everything else as well. So
number one is project harmony and peace.
And recognize that your thought is not just a miscellaneous background thing going on. That your thought is a primary contributor to your health and your behavior and the life you experience on this planet. You change your thoughts, you change your life. And then I go, wow, but life I thought was controlled by genes. Number two, the idea, genes control my life. If you believe that, which is what everybody's been programmed essentially to believe, I say, what does it mean? Well, I asked you a simple question. Alan, as far as you know, did you pick the genes you came with, yes or no? What do you think?
I would think probably not. They just showed up.
And then I say, but the genes control your traits. Then I say, if you don't like your traits, can you change your genes? The answer is no. So all of a sudden you say, wait a minute. I didn't pick the genes. The genes control who I am. I don't control who they are. By definition, I am a victim. I'm a victim of heredity. It's like my life is predetermined by genes, and I can't control them. And it turns out, as soon as you buy your victim, you become what? Disempowered. Mm-hmm. If I'm a victim, I'm saying that because it means I have no power.
Right.
And so we have programmed all the people out there to say, I am not powerful in controlling my life. My illness and my problems do not come from me. They come from my biology. So if I get cancer, I have stupid biology and had nothing to do with me. And the problem is, no, it had everything to do with you, because the new science is called epigenetics versus genetics. And you go, they sound the same to me. And I go, genetics is associated with a concept called genetic control, which is controlled by genes. That's the belief system. My life is controlled by genes. If I got the cancer gene, I'm going to get the cancer. Then I go, wait a minute. The new science is called epigenetics. You go, it sounds the same. I go, no. Epi means above. So when I say epigenetics, and I actually say epigenetic control, what am I literally saying? I'm saying control above the genes.
So the genes is the physical mechanism.
Yeah,
but
they don't operate by themselves. Right. And we bought into it. I mean, you must have heard it. You probably even said it.
Yeah.
A gene turns on.
Yeah.
A gene turns off. And I go, first, that is totally false. 100% false. Why? A gene doesn't control itself. That's what we said. Gene turned on. I say, what? You mean the gene made a decision? Well, that's what they say. Yeah, the cancer gene turned on and then you got cancer. I go, wait. A gene is a blueprint. It is exactly what it is, a blueprint. I say, what? Because that's, let's give the example. You're in an architect's office and she's working on a blueprint. You lean over the architect and you point and you say, is your blueprint on or is your blueprint off? And she would look at you like, what are you talking about?
It's
a
blueprint.
It's no on and off. I go, precisely. A gene is a blueprint. It has no on and off. doesn't control itself. And then all of a sudden you're left with, well, wait, the genes aren't controlling it, so what's controlling it? So epigenetics, above the genes. I said, what's above the genes?
Yeah, what?
The environment and your perception of the environment. If you change the environment or you change your perception of the environment, you will immediately change your genetic activity. I go, wait a minute.
Let me then just absorb that. If I change, but there are genes, like if I'm eating, you know, breakfast, I'm not telling which enzymes to be activated. That's sort of automatic.
Well, yes, you are, without you even knowing about it. That's why... That's why, you know, it's very difficult to understand, because preceding your experience in life is first a thought. And if the thought is you can't do it or you can do it, then the resolution is already determined by that thought. Mm-hmm. And you go, you mean, wait, the thought precedes the biology? And I go, absolutely. And I'll give you an example. Placebo effect. What's a placebo effect? Oh, here's a pill that is the newest technology, the greatest breakthrough, and you know that illness that you haven't been able to deal with? This new pill, oh, this is going to heal you. Take this pill. You take the pill, you get better, and then what do you find out? You find out later that the pill was just a sugar pill.
Right.
I go, well, then first tell me, then what or who healed you? Did sugar heal you?
Right.
The answer is, no, sugar didn't do that. And I said, well, why did it? I said, you're... belief about the pill,
right? All but sudden, I mean, I agree with you. But there are elements in nature that can be beneficial to healing, though. We have to acknowledge.
Well, yeah, but that's the part of what are you trying to do? Is make harmony in the system? Why energy is? I said, when energy is in harmony, it's music and it's beautiful. And when energy is out of harmony, it's noise and it hurts. And I say, so what's in what is harmony? I said, well, you live in a world that everything has energy in it. Feng shui, that's a perfect one. I said, what the hell is feng shui? I said, well, you put this object over here and this one over here, and you set up these objects and you make a little crystal-like structure. And I said, well, what is it doing? And I said, the Asians had already known for thousands of years, everything gives off energy. It's all, well, you see it as a physical element, they understood it as a source of energy. So when they were moving objects around, they weren't moving objects, they were moving energy, like moving this note to this level and this frequency to this level. And I say, what? Oh, by balancing the energy, I can make harmony, music, out of a place that is in disharmony. Ah, so feng shui is what? Putting physical things in to change the energy field. Well, does that include food? I go, yeah, that includes food. It includes everything you do in the world that's physical. And the question is, will you let it in or not? But that has to do with a thought. And I say, people say, look, macrobiotic diet. You got cancer. The only way out, eat that macrobiotic diet. And I go, okay, there's some cancer patients. And you say, the only way out, eat macrobiotic diet. They eat that diet. And guess what? They die faster than the other people. I said, well, I thought macrobiotic diet was healing. I said, based on the belief system of the individual. If they don't believe that this is what's going to help them and they do it, then it doesn't help them.
So there's the feel, there's the interaction of harmony, but what overrides that is, you're saying, is human thought and intention.
Absolutely.
Overrides
now,
the energy.
Let's just clarify this one last part about that, Alan, and that is this. When we were talking about placebo effect, what were we talking about? Positive belief. Yeah. I have a positive belief I'm going to get healed because this is the drug that I was told that's going to heal me. I have very positive belief. Mm-hmm. So it's basically the positive nature of that belief, and then taking the drug is really just saying, I'm pursuing my positive belief. I'm taking the drug. It's the positive belief that healed you, not the sugar.
And that
cup.
Belief changes the enzymes, the genetics, the genes itself.
That's absolutely what it does. You know, here's a simple fact. Yeah. Okay, let's just come back, and then I'll give you a simple fact.
Yeah.
Placebo effect is the result of having a positive belief in healing. I say, oh. What about a negative belief? I go, oh, guess what? You don't hear about it. It's not talked about. But a negative belief is equally powerful in controlling your life as a positive belief, but it works in the opposite direction. A positive belief can heal you, placebo effect. A negative belief can kill you, and it's called nocebo effect. And relevance, why is it important? Because negative beliefs are powerful. I say, well, yeah, but people don't understand that. Psychologists will tell you 70% or so of your thoughts are negative, disempowering, self-sabotaging, limiting beliefs. I go, if 70% of the thoughts coming out of your head are negative, and negative belief is powerful but makes you unhealthy, then you look at the world and you go, yeah, as soon as everybody starts getting afraid, as soon as they start seeing negative worlds, as soon as they, you know, the fear of their survival is in question, all of a sudden, guess what? It's associated with disease, ill health, and death. Mm. It's like, oh my God, it's the way you were thinking. Mm. And I said, yeah, positive thinking can heal you, placebo. Mm. Negative thinking can kill you, nocebo. And I say, well, how effective is that thinking? Now, this is how precise. This is so fabulous if you think about it. I go like this. Look, I hypnotize you. I tell you, I'm going to touch you with a burning cigarette. And so in your hypnotic subconscious mind, you perceive I'm going to touch you now with a burning cigarette. I take my finger and I just touch you, boom, on my wrist. Well, you believe I've just had a burning cigarette. I go, so what's the result? I say, within minutes, most of these individuals will have a blister. And I go, from what? From the burn. I say, yeah, but there was no burn. I touched it with my finger. I go, yeah, but the belief system saw the burn. And the belief system not just made a blister, but made it precisely exactly where you touched yourself is where the blister formed. So it wasn't a coincidence or accident. It was a complete mind-creating blister on a belief of being burned, even though you weren't burned.
So how do we go back to that original idea that belief systems are creating this mass extinction? We have to go in. You've just laid out some points to change our belief system. But it's such, you know, changing your core belief systems, which have been neurologically imprinted in the brain, is probably the hardest thing to do.
No, that's the part that's so wonderful.
Okay, good.
That's belief in itself.
Okay,
that's
thank you.
If I believe change is hard,
okay,
and my life is a confirmation of my belief,
right,
then when I try to change my belief, it's going to be a very hard and difficult thing.
All right, change is easy. Thank you.
It's very critical. Why is there a problem? And the problem is this. We talk about the mind controlling biology. I go, yeah, but the mind is not a single entity. The mind is two entities. A conscious, creative mind connected to your spirituality. Who you are is an energy specific to you that is partly located in, or at least received in your, what are called the prefrontal cortex, right behind your forehead, mm-hmm. where consciousness resides. Mm-hmm. And I go, okay, so consciousness is part of the mind. I go, yeah, but the mind that was there before consciousness evolved was called the subconscious mind. Why? It works without you thinking about it. It's automatic. It's a habit mind. I go, good. Then I say, oh, well, then the mind is actually two interdependent components, a conscious mind and subconscious. And I go, now that's where the problem comes from, because if you say the mind is a unity, mm-hmm. then you fail to understand there are two parts. And why is it important to understand that? And here's the answer. Because each mind, conscious and subconscious, has a different function. And more importantly, they learn in different ways.
Oh.
So it says, oh, you can educate the conscious mind, but in any way, did that change the subconscious program? I go, absolutely not. Absolutely not. I say, oh, well, then here's what the problem is.
Yeah.
We keep educating the conscious mind. I say, how? Well, this program of yours, Alan, for years has been educating people's conscious mind. I say, lectures. You go to a lecture, you get education. You watch a video program, you get education. You can get an education by going, aha, I just got a new idea. I just changed my conscious mind. I say, oh, good. So you can educate the conscious mind. I say, yeah. For example, I say, how many people read a self-help book? And in an audience, everybody hands go up. And I go, and how many of you has your life changed after you finish reading the book? And most of the hands go down. I go, well,
so
you,
how do we change the
nature of the book.
Mind? Yes,
what's that?
That's the question. How do we change the subconscious mind?
Because you can only teach it in the way it learns, not the way the conscious mind learns. And that's what the difference is. Reading the book educated the conscious mind. Did it educate the subconscious? No, it didn't work in that way. So you're still operating from the same program. I said, well, if I want to change the subconscious, how do I do it? I said, well, you have to understand how the subconscious learns. And there are three fundamental ways the subconscious mind learns. The first is, during the first 7 years of your life, your subconscious was downloading programs because your brain activity, EEG, was in a lower vibration than consciousness as predominant state. It was in theta. Theta is imagination. Yeah, but that's, you see, that's the character of children. They can mix the real world and the imaginary world together seamlessly. Why? Because their brain is operating in theta. And I go, yeah, but theta is also hypnosis. Theta is hypnosis, meaning the first 7 years, you're in a state of hypnosis. And I said, what do you mean? It's like, well, your brain is like a video camera. Everything it sees, it downloads the behavior. You watch your mother, you get her behavior. You watch your father, you get his behavior. You watch your siblings, you get their behavior. You watch your community. For 7 years, you are being programmed with behavior. You're not creating with consciousness. That's not a predominant brain state until after seven. First 7 years is download. And I go, okay, so how did I get it? Well, the first 7 years you learn because your brain was in a state of hypnosis.
Right.
You want to learn again using hypnosis? Then every night as you go to bed, you put some earphones on your head and you listen to a recorded message. Why? Because as you're going from conscious levels, which are higher vibrations in EEG, to delta, which is sleep, you pass through theta. Theta is imagination. So just as you're going out unconscious, essentially, in sleep, your brain is kicking into theta. So if you put the earphones on, listen to a program, then that information is not going into the conscious mind. It's going in the subconscious mind. Now, that's how you can change a program. Number two.
I see. That's key. That's really important. So how do you change the subconscious mind of the whole civilization that is bent on, you know, Darwinian, Newtonian, Descartesian?
Those beliefs that were downloaded are controlling your life. And if they're wrong, then your life, by definition, is out of control.
Right.
And therefore, the new beliefs have to come in. And therefore, you'll get in harmony with the way the universe works. And then you're in harmony with life. And so, first 7 years, the brain is designed to download behavior into the subconscious. After age seven, you can make new programs. You do all the time. I said, but how do you make a new program after age seven? I go, oh, after age seven, the way to make a new program in the subconscious is repetition. Habituation. How many times did you say A, B, C until you could get all the way to Z? You started, you get about a certain way in, then you falter, and then you go, the next one is P. Okay, so then you start all over again, you get past P, you falter, you say, oh, the next one is R or whatever, something. And I say, until you repeat that, until what? Until you can get all the way to A and Z. And then I say, what happens when you get to A to Z and you can do it? You've done it. It's over with. You don't need to do it again. Anytime you need the alphabet, boom. It's right there in the program. Okay?
So do you think there's like a tipping point? If enough people change their belief system, do you think it has an energetic effect on the rest of humanity to change?
100%. 100%. And I say why? Because I talked about the invisible energy fields are shaping the world in which we live. And then I say, yeah, but your thoughts are the energy, those energy fields. And then you might say, yeah, but the thoughts in my head, how can it affect the people out there, the world outside of me? Because my thought is in my head. And I go, when I put wires on your head and I read your brain activity, EEG, yes, I'm reading the electrical activity of the brain that has been conducted through the skin. And I'm reading that activity on the surface of the skin. But I say, there's a new process, it's not electroencephalograph, it's called magnetoencephalograph. It reads the magnetic field of the brain. And I say, well, why is that technology important? And here's why it's so important. The probe is out here. The probe is out here. And I say, what do you mean the probe is out here? I say, I'm reading your brain activity without touching you. I say, well, why is that important? I say, because your brain activity is not contained in your head. It's a broadcast. You're a tuning fork. All of us are tuning forks.
Oh.
So I say, yeah, well, what happens if you get a large number of tuning forks on the exact same frequency? Oh, I go, oh, then the amplitude, the power of that energy is totally enhanced. So I say, yeah, the more people with the same thought, the more the broadcast is uniform, the more the broadcast is uniform, the more powerful is the energy field, and it's the force of that energy field that shapes matter. So if you get a large number of people thinking the same thought, then you manifest the reality. So all of a sudden it says, what the quantum physicists told us in 1930, nobody listened to them. Mm-hmm. The quantum physicists said, in Newtonian physics, the world looks like a great machine, a great mechanism. In quantum physics, no, it's more of a great thought than a great mechanism. Why? Because quantum physicists recognize from the very beginning, the get-go, from the very beginning, that consciousness is fundamental in shaping and creating the world that we experience. I say, well, relevance? Change your consciousness and you change the world that we live in.
And you also change your genes.
Exactly.
And the other question I want to ask you about epigenetics, you not just change your genes, but then you change the reproductive genes. And so that's really what I feel is meant by the benefits or the evolution of epigenetics, is that you have a new thought, you have a new desire, then your offspring talk about that a little bit, because I think that's where it's really important.
Yeah, you know, look, when we talk about evolution, we talk about Charlie Darwin, and we talk about Charlie Darwin's theory, which is summarized, you know, inappropriately, but actually correctly, as a world based on a struggle for survival with a competition for fitness. And then I say, look, yeah, look at the world we just created, a whole world based on struggle and survival and competition. I go, yeah, well, it fit our belief system. I go, yeah, but is that theory right? And I say, you know, everyone says Darwin came up with a theory of evolution. That's total BS, which is belief system. That's total belief system, because the truth is Darwin did not come up with a theory of evolution.
Right, because he never explained how one species became another species. He said there was adaptation, but he did not specify the mechanism for speciation.
No, and and that's why it started off with random. He said, look, you mate two dogs, you get a litter of puppies, and 9 out of 10 are just like the parents and all the traits, and then there's one called the runt of a litter. And you say, well, can you predict that? I say, no, you can't predict that. You don't know which one's going to be the runt. So he says, oh, a hereditary change that produces a runt was an accident. I go, yeah. Then he just takes that. He says, yeah, but what if you get this runt and you breed it with that runt? You're going to get a family of runts. I said, yeah, but if you keep breeding the weirdos, you can move out of the existing structure, the species. And if you keep breeding the weirdos, you can move into another species. And this is why
you really move into another species, though?
Well, theoretically, maybe, possibly so, but then you're still leaving out the fact that the environment is responsible for changing this, and the environment doesn't support the species. That species is gone.
Right.
Dinosaurs lived in a world with a different environment, and it encouraged them, but when the environment changed, the dinosaurs disappeared.
Right.
So it's really a connection of two. And Lamarck, 50 years before Darwin, Lamarck published the first scientific paper on a theory of evolution. He was right. He was right. Evolution occurred. He gave science for it. The difference between Lamarck and Darwin is Lamarck, the earlier version, suggested that there was a relationship between the environment and the organism, so that there was an instructional relationship. As the environment changed, it changed the organism to be compatible with the environment, so that evolution wasn't an accident. We were adapting continuously to the environment. Darwinian theory takes away that adaptation and says, no, it was all an accident. And so this is where Darwin is wrong, and now we're beginning to find out Lamarck is right. As you said, what happens to me in my life today can influence my offspring. And it's not that I changed my genes, I changed my epigenetics. And it's like, okay, that's going to be a little confusing, but it's like there's a gene, which is a blueprint, and then there's a way of reading the blueprint. So epigenetics can change the way you read it, but not necessarily change the gene. Point? I still have the same gene, but I can read it in many different ways. So we now find, for example, that a gene, which is a blueprint to make a protein in the body, that through environmental interactions, one gene can create up to 3,000 different proteins by the way it's read. And all of a sudden it says, oh my God, you're not limited by the genes. You're limited, if anything, by the way you read the genes, but that's you. Ah, your beliefs, your perceptions, your attitudes. You think you're going to get cancer? Then you will send information to your cells that will generate cancer. You will manifest your beliefs.
So if you think you're going to be healthy and strong and vital and intelligent, then it's not just thinking, it's knowing it, believing it, and feeling it that changes the expression.
That's why it's so important when you're raising a child is to recognize, remember I said the first 7 years you download the programs from other people. You may ask now, why would you do that? Why don't you just have your own programs? And I'll give you a simple reason. I say, look, you go to the Apple store and you buy a brand new iPod. You take it out of the box. And on the front screen, the touch screen, there's all these different things. You can select the music, you can change the volume, you can make a music list, you can go fast forward, you can change it. Ah, the touch screen is like creative. I can create a music list, mm-hmm. and I can create the parameters of playing that music. So I say, the touch screen is conscious mind, creative. I say, you get a brand new iPod, take it out of the box, and I say, push play. Nothing happens. And all those people around you are snickering and going, yeah, yeah. You know what? Because you didn't download any music. So how can you play any music if you didn't download any music? It's like, you cannot be conscious unless you have some program to be conscious of. That is why nature made the first 7 years programmable. Put the program in. Consciousness kicks in at around age 7, can use the program. But when you become very conscious, you can recognize, but I can change the program. Then you have power. Then you have freedom. But if you don't realize you can change the program, then you are run by the program. So here's a simple fact. everyone almost has seen the movie called The Matrix. I go, what's the premise? The premise is that we've all been programmed, and that if you take a blue pill, you go back into the program, and life is always the way it is. If you take a red pill, you get out of the program. So I'm going to tell you a simple fact. A, Matrix is not a science fiction movie. The Matrix is a documentary. We have all been programmed. And that these programs control our lives. And I go, is this something new that science has just discovered? And I go, no, no. The Jesuits, 400 years, have said, give me a child until it's 6 or 7, it will belong to the church for the rest of its life. I go, do you understand what they just said? They've been saying that for 400 years. You have any idea what they're saying?
Right.
I say, exactly, here's what they're saying. You give me the download program of 7 years, and I will control the fate of that child, irregardless of what their intention is. This child will always belong to the church because I programmed it to be that way. And I go, oh, Jesus, it is the Matrix. We've been programmed. And I say, do you think that program enhances you? And I go, well, no. Psychologists will tell you the programming that we have been passed down is predominantly disempowering programs. I say, oh, my God, then our power as a human has been diminished by the program. And I go, yeah, you think the Jesuits are the only ones that knew about programming? Are you kidding me? In today's world, those people that regulate programming are far better at it than the Jesuits could have ever imagined. And we've all been programmed. I say, so then our life is not our life. Our life is an expression of a program that we have been given, a program of Darwinian competition, a program of being a victim to our genes, a program that life is based on competition, all these things. I say, these are programs. I say, these programs are on your life because now we know 95% of your life comes from the programs.
Right.
I go, whoa, what about my creative wishes and desires? I hear, oh, that's conscious mind. That controls 5%. And then all of a sudden you start to realize, wait a minute, my life doesn't match my wishes and desires. I go, yeah, why not? Because you're only using wishes and desires, conscious mind, 5% of the time. You are operating from subconscious 95% of the time. And so your life is not really yours. Your life has been programmed. And I go, well, what happens if you get out of the program? I say, well, you take the red pill. You say, yeah, but what the heck is a red pill? I say, well, you know what? Almost everybody out there has taken a red pill without knowing they did. I say, well, what is the red pill? I'll give you one example. One of the red pills is falling in love. What do you mean falling in love? I say, look at your life before you met somebody that you fell in love with. Every day was blah, blah, life, blah, blah, hard, trouble, struggle, whatever, blah, blah, blah. Then you meet this one person, and the next day is like, oh, my God, life is so beautiful.
This is the honeymoon effect you're talking about.
Yeah, it's the honeymoon effect. I said, well, how'd you create from all the way up to this moment till you met this person, life was trouble and not supporting and whatever it is, and then you meet this person, and the next day is like, oh, you're healthier, you got more energy, you're so happy with life, you can't wait for the next day because it's all coming in beautiful, and it's called the honeymoon. I go, what was that all about? And here's the answer. It's the equivalent of taking the red pill. The honeymoon is an expression of the first time in your life that you're not following the program, that you're actually now operating from your conscious mind, which is what? Wishes and desires. I say, what happened when you let go of the program and started operating from wishes and desires? The answer is the first thing you did was create heaven on earth. I go, oh, that was already available to me, except for the program didn't let me get there. And I go, yeah, we've been programmed. We've been disempowered. I say, well, wait a minute. What do you mean by that? I say, let me give you a fact. Every human is equally powerful in their potential. Every human is equally powerful. I said, well, then how did some humans, let's say like Bill Gates, get all that power? And you say, oh, did they get more powerful? Joke? No. I said, well, they have all this power. How'd they get all that power? I say, they didn't get more powerful. They took away your power. And when you got less powerful, they became more powerful. So you've been programmed to be disempowered. Why? To control you. And the church knew about controlling you for 400 years. And I said, that thought is not lost. The world of the Illuminati, they know exactly what the hell to do.
No, but what you just said is that we all have the power to live in that peace and be in love, not just because we've met somebody, but because that's our nature to be in love.
That, right. As soon as you relieve yourself of a program that constricts you to a belief system and makes you manifest that belief system. When you let go of that program, you are no longer a prisoner of that belief system. And the moment you let go of that program of victim and struggle and fight, and you end up being in love, all of a sudden it's like, even the same job that yesterday was a piece of crap, is like, today it's okay, I don't really care, I'm doing a job. Why? Because as soon as I get home, I'm gonna have my love relationship. It's like, oh yeah, guess what? You change your belief system. But the unfortunate part about why the honeymoon is interesting, because it is a moment where you actually stop playing the program, and the result of stop playing the program, the taking of the red pill, meant that your life profoundly changed from before you fell in love, which was, you know, life was boring, struggle, whatever you want to talk about it was, to the moment you fell in love and all of a sudden life is now completely different. I said, what's different about it? And the answer was, well, now that I've fallen in love, I'm operating from my conscious mind, which is creative, wishes and desires, manifesting wishes and desires, manifesting the love that I want. But at some point, even in, the honeymoon starts to fade away. And I say, why? Well, let's answer the first question. Why am I operating from my subconscious mind 95% of the time? Why not run conscious mind? I say, because there's a very unique part of the conscious mind that makes it so powerful, and that is that it can think. And I say, well, what happens when it's thinking? So I say to you, Alan, I say, listen, Alan, what are you doing on Tuesday at 4 o'clock? Mm-hmm. Now you have to think. I say, well, what does it mean when you have to think? I say, you have to go in your head. You have to go back and say, what am I doing? What am I doing on that day, 4 o'clock? And you're thinking. And I say, well, what's happening when you're thinking? I say, huh? Your conscious mind's not paying attention. Your conscious mind's deep into your head. It's thinking about what's going to happen on Tuesday. And I go, well, does that mean the moment you start thinking, you stop everything that you're doing? And I go, absolutely not. The moment that you are thinking is you default to the subconscious program. So I say, oh, well, then how much thinking do we do during the day? And the answer is 95%. So I say, oh, then 95% of the day, my conscious mind's thinking, so my behavior is automatically controlled by default by the subconscious. I say, yeah, if you're walking and you have a thought, you don't stop walking. You continue walking. Yeah, the subconscious is more powerful.
So you're saying being present, being in control of our life, being creative, being in the moment, in the flow, brings back the power to the conscious mind so our subconscious programs don't run us.
Absolutely. But then the problem is our world is so busy that it's a very difficult process to keep your conscious mind present. Mindfulness. I say, yeah, except falling in love is an automatic mechanism that encourages mindfulness. And that's why when you fall in love, your life is dramatically different than it was the day before you fell in love. And I say, well, what's the relevance about it? I say, well, because once you have started to do your own creation without the program, you got healthy, you got happy, and life was heaven on earth. But once you start thinking again, because look, I can be in love for a while, but I still have a job.
Yeah.
I still got to pay the rent. I got to take care of my chores, which means as soon as life starts to intrude, I have to start thinking about all the things I do. And I say, the moment you start thinking is the moment you default to those subconscious behaviors. And I go, yeah, but those aren't your behaviors. Those are the programs you got from your parents. And you start to see that sometimes you behave like your parent, and it almost is embarrassing. You say, oh my God, it was just like my dad. It's just like my mom when I did that. I'm so embarrassed. And the fact was, here's what I tell people in a lecture, Alan, and they laugh. And why it's important for me, because as I see, the audience generally gets it as a whole. And I go, listen, go back in your life. I'm sure at some point in your life, you were very close to a friend. You knew your friend's behavior very, very, very well. And you happen to know your friend's parent. And one day you start to see that your friend and their parent have some of the same behavior. You know, it's real exciting. You make a connection. And so you really want to tell your friend, and you go, hey, you know, Bill, you're just like your dad. And then I say, back away from Bill. Mm. Why? The moment you say to Bill, he's just like his dad, what's the most inevitable response is, how can you compare me to my dad? I'm not like my dad. I'm me. I'm not my dad. And there's a great, like, you know, denial. I am not like my dad. Well, then I say, well, here's an interesting point. Everyone else can see that Bill behaves like his dad. The only one who doesn't see it is Bill. I go, well, what does that mean? I go, well, where did he get the behavior? Downloaded. First 7 years. Downloaded his dad's behavior. It's built into the subconscious. I go, great. Why doesn't he see when he's playing? And I say, well, why is he playing his default subconscious program? And the answer is because his conscious mind's busy thinking. Oh, if the conscious mind's busy thinking, then by definition, it's not paying attention. And therefore, when you're thinking and you default to the subconscious program, you're the one that doesn't see it. Everybody else does.
Let me just understand this. So thinking, when we are asked to like leave the present moment and go somewhere else, like even in reading a newspaper article and watching a movie or whatever, we're taken away from the present input of the conscious mind, and by thinking, the default programs take over and run our lives.
Absolutely. So the whole significance is that the body works on two systems, manual control and autopilot. Autopilot is subconscious. Conscious is manual control. If you're in manual control, then you're controlling the behavior to manifest your wishes and desires. But when you put it on autopilot, you're going to just totally respond to what the program is. And if that program isn't yours, you're going to still respond to it, but you're the one that's not going to see it. And since most of those behaviors are turned out to be negative and disempowering, then since 95% of the day, you are not going toward your destination. Right. You are, in fact, playing programs that will actually sabotage you from going to that destination, and you're the one that's not going to see it. And I say, what is the bottom line consequence? And it goes like this. I wake up in the morning with a conscious wish to either become healthy that day, to find a relationship that day, to find a great job. I don't care. That's a wish, whatever it is. I say you go out in the morning and you go all day and you come home at 5 o'clock, tail between your legs, beat by the system, not getting to where you wanted to go. I started in the morning. I wanted to go to destination A. At the end of the day, I'm in destination B. It's not where I wanted to go. And you say, well, it's not me. Because I'm the guy that had the great vision of destination A, so ending up in destination B, that wasn't mine. That was the universe. It was, you know, fate. It was things out of my control.
No, it was because just the subconscious program, you're saying. It was
just the program that sabotaged you. You didn't see it. You end up in the other place, and then you blame, well, not yourself. Why? Because you didn't see you were participating. It was invisible.
So how do we go back in and change that subconscious program?
And there you go, my friend Alan, and that is the whole answer to life, and that is why, you know, what the Matrix movie was about. Get out of the damn thing and create a new program. You can rewrite your program. And I say, well, what's the relevance? And here's the simple relevance. When I operated on my conscious wishes and desires, I created heaven on earth. When I defaulted to my subconscious, it turned back into hell. So I said, well, wait a minute. What if I take my beliefs that constitute wishes and desires and use those as a program to rewrite the programs in my subconscious so they match my wishes and desires? And I go, you know what? 5% of the day, you're consciously moving toward your wishes and desires. And 95% of the day, you are subconsciously moving toward your wishes and desires. So 100% of the day, you're moving toward your wishes and desires. And so the concept that comes down, and it's very simple, is this, that heaven on earth is not necessarily a short moment. Heaven on earth is a way of life you can have every day of your life.
Thank you. But how do we go in there and rewrite those? What's the actual mechanism by listening?
There are three mechanisms. There are three mechanisms. I mentioned them, and I said there's only three ways the subconscious learns. I got to two of them. I said, right. A, hypnosis. You want to change your program? Then use hypnosis, subliminal tapes that used to be called. B, after you're seven, you can make new programs, but how'd you do that? By habituation, by engaging in a program like an exercise and doing it every stinking day.
Right.
And at some point, it's like, now it's automatic. Yeah, because it's called a habit, okay? And C, the most important one, because of the fact that we are so close to a crisis in our planet that change is inevitable. If we continue the same behavior, then, of course, the writing's on the wall. So evolution says change your behavior. I say, well, how can you change your behavior quickly? And all of a sudden I say, necessity is the mother of invention. And guess what? Something new is invented. It's called energy psychology. And these are belief change modification technologies that you can change beliefs in your subconscious in minutes. And this is like, wow, this is so necessary, because the faster you change your beliefs, the faster the world changes. For you personally, and for all of us collectively.
And what is like just an example of the energy psychology that people use?
Well, body code, Psyche.
Psyche.
Listen, very simple point. On my website, which is easy, brucelipton.com, under resources, I have a listing of belief change modification techniques, energy psychology techniques. There's 20 or more of them. They're all pretty much the same in regard that they engage a super learning process, and it's through super learning that we can rewrite that subconscious. So there are three fundamental ways. Reading a self-help book will not do it. Going to a lecture will not do it. Listening to this wonderful program will not do it.
That'll do it.
These affect the conscious mind.
Yeah.
But hypnosis, habituation, or energy psychology, if you want to rewrite the subconscious, that is the way the subconscious learns. So if you try to do anything other than those three, it will likely not be very effective.
Right. Okay. Thank you. That's very clear, I think, important. One question, though. Epigenetics. Do you think you just answered the old question of what came first, the chicken or the egg, when you talked about it? No, I'm serious, because it's chicken changes, the egg changes.
Absolutely, but if the egg changes first, then the resulting chicken is different. So the changes come from, and most of the changes come from during the reproduction process itself, so that the organisms that reproduce were there before the new organism was created. A new organism is derived from a pre-existing organism. So before the chicken, there was an egg, but it wasn't necessarily a chicken egg. But as a result of hereditary changes, this runt of the litter, so to speak, this egg is going to be different than the offspring from the other eggs in the nest at the same time.
That's Lamarckian. That's the essence of Lamarckian's
evolution. Yeah, it says we can influence this. And if we can influence it, then I said our belief systems, we are victims of our heredity. The new science says, no, you are the master. You create the cancer. It didn't come from the genes. Only 1% of disease comes from the genes. The rest is... we created it by living the way we're living. And the result is, yeah, but if I change the way I'm living, then I change my genetics. And the answer is, in epigenetics, absolutely true. You can change genetics in 8 hours. So meditation, for example, you can change your genetics. So this is the new science. It's a science of empowerment, and it's a required science for us to understand, so we stop pretending we're the victims. Because I said, if you believe you're a victim, remember, it's placebo, nocebo. A victim belief is a nocebo. But it will manifest itself if you believe it. And that's the issue. If you believe you're a victim, you become a victim.
Right. And so we're changing that. Now, this last question, do you believe there's a point in our history, our collective history, where we wake up? And that is just, everyone's taken the red pill. We know it. And we do have a heaven on earth.
Yes.
When is that happening?
If it's going to happen, because it's... that we've been here before. This is not the first civilization to come to mastery of the environment itself. I mean, there were massive civilizations that were here that died out 10,000 years ago. And so, you know, it's like it's turning out that there are cycles here, and we're ending a cycle. The question is, will we make the jump or will we not make the jump? And the answer is, I don't know. It could be 50-50 as far as I know.
Well, let's put out the positive belief that we will.
I firmly believe it, because I already know so many people that have moved out of the belief system, taken that red pill, gone out of this belief system, and live in a very healthy, wonderful environment in the midst of a world falling apart. Mm-hmm. And it's like, well, that's your choice. You can be in the world falling apart, or what we're really being asked to do is join another world that is building and is healthy and in harmony, and that's a choice. And you ask, when's that choice? I say, well, it's not very far off in the future, because extinction is looming not 100 years from now. Within 100 years, extinction is a likely possibility. So changes are going to occur within the next few years. Right now is the time of change. And that's why it's so important for people to become knowledgeable. Why? Simple point. Knowledge is power. When everybody says, yeah, I've heard that, and I said, well, let's make it more pointed and more direct. A lack of knowledge is a lack of power. We have been deprived of fundamental knowledge of how humans work and their mechanisms. And I say, why is that important? Because if you don't have the knowledge of how your biology works, then you are powerless in controlling your biology. And this is why there's a new science and a new biology, and therefore a new evolution in front
of us.
What's
even worse than no knowledge is false, wrong knowledge, which we...
Yeah, because it's not just no knowledge, but it's knowledge that in this case is nocebo and can kill you. And I go, yep, that's what we're facing right now. There's a massive audience of people looking for what? New answers, new ways of life.
I appreciate your time, of course. I look forward to seeing you. You're a one-man revolution.
I'm a happy boy, if nothing else, Alan. You know that.
I know. You've worked hard, and I know you've thought about these things for a long time before you came public and wrote your first book, and you were, you know, and boom, it's all paid off by taking the chance that you did to be original and different, and you're making a huge difference in biology, in people's lives. So thanks again. Always good to see you.
Alan, I look forward to seeing you again, my brother, because I so appreciate all the work you're doing and helping us evolve. Thank you, my cultural creative brother.
Thanks, Bruce. Bruce Lipton.
This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities, and if you want to contact me at newrealities@earthlink.net or check my website, newrealities.com. Thank you for listening.